Lecture 11, Laughter-Loving Aphrodite.
Hello, and welcome back to Lecture 11. In the previous lecture, we looked at Hermes and Dionysus, Zeus's two youngest sons among the Olympians. In this lecture, we're going to conclude our discussion of individual gods and goddesses and their attributes and functions by looking at Aphrodite, the goddess of sexual passion and desire. According to Theogony, as you'll remember, Aphrodite was born from the foam that appeared around Uranus's severed genitals when Cronos tossed them into the sea. That's one version of her birth story. According to another, which appears in the Iliad, she is the daughter of Zeus and a goddess named Dione. So, like many other gods, Aphrodite has at least two versions of how she came into existence. But whichever version is followed, she's normally portrayed as a young woman at the high point of sexual attractiveness. If Hesiod's version of her birth is followed, then actually she's one of the very oldest of goddesses, but she's not more portrayed as a mature woman, unlike, say, Hera, Demeter, or Hestia. She's shown as a young woman, which makes sense for a goddess who personifies sexual desire. Now, as the goddess of sexual desire, Aphrodite is extremely powerful. She can and does subdue even Zeus to her will. She can inflict sexual desire on Zeus, make him have affairs with mortal women, with other goddesses, with whomever she wants him to have an affair with. The only beings she cannot touch are the three virgin goddesses, Hestia, Artemis, and Athena. They are, so to speak, immune to Aphrodite. But every other living being, god, human, and animal, is vulnerable to Aphrodite's power. And by the way, I call her the goddess of sexual desire or passion rather than the goddess of love, the way she's so often described, because I don't think she is a goddess of love. She is not a goddess of affection or devotion or lifelong companionship or soulmates. She is a goddess of sexual passion, which, as we'll see later in the lecture, can be a remarkably transitory thing in Greek myth. Now, Aphrodite appears in many, many works of literature. It might almost be safe to say in most works of ancient literature. There's at least some reference to her. However, for understanding her essential nature, once again, we're going to turn to a Homeric hymn as our starting point. The Homeric hymn to Aphrodite recounts the story of Aphrodite's affair or sexual encounter with a human man named Anchises. This affair is well attested elsewhere in ancient literature because the son that resulted from it was Aeneas, the hero of Virgil's epic, the Aeneid, and supposedly the ancestor of the Roman race. So elsewhere in literature, we hear mentioned the idea that Aphrodite had an affair with Anchises and by it conceived a son, Aeneas. This is mentioned not just in the Aeneid, but also in Homer's Iliad. However, in the Homeric hymn, the author concentrates not on Aeneas, the offspring of the union, though he is mentioned near the end of the poem. Rather, the Homeric hymn concentrates on the affair itself, on Aphrodite's encounter with Anchises. The hymn begins by stating that Zeus was angry at Aphrodite for causing him and other gods to become sexually involved with humans, that Zeus resented this, was angry about it, and therefore decided to give Aphrodite a taste of her own medicine, so to speak. Now, one implication of this is that Zeus and the other gods see sexual relations with humans as somehow beneath their dignity, somehow degrading. Zeus is angry at Aphrodite because she makes him take part in these encounters, which he regrets later as being beneath his dignity. Another implication of the idea that Zeus punishes Aphrodite by infecting her with desire for Anchises has to do with the idea of gods having separate spheres of influence. Normally, in Greek myth, the gods do not trespass on one another's domains. Aphrodite does not cause earthquakes. Poseidon does not imbue people with sexual passion. Hermes does not shoot arrows that kill men suddenly. The gods tend, by and large, to respect one another's separate spheres of influence. This respecting the boundaries of influence probably has to do, again, with the idea that these gods embody or personify the emotions and activities they govern. In other words, there's a sense in which Aphrodite is sexual passion. She's sexual passion itself, given a visible, tangible body. But Zeus, as the ruler of the gods, has the ability, though the hymn does not explain how, to inflict sexual passion itself or herself with sexual passion. He turns Aphrodite's powers against her. He makes her feel irresistible desire for Anchises, as she, Aphrodite, has so often made Zeus feel irresistible desire for many different human women. So Zeus inspires Aphrodite with passion for the young Trojan prince Anchises, whom she will seduce. Now, this happens, by the way, in the generation before the Trojan War. Anchises is a young man at this point. He's an old man during the time when the Trojan War takes place. Aphrodite appears before Anchises in disguise as a young girl and tells him that she is destined to be his bride. Remember, gods and goddesses can appear in any form they choose. Demeter, for instance, appears in the Homeric hymn before Metanira as an old woman. Here, Aphrodite disguises herself as a young girl just at the right age for marriage, just about 13 or 14 years old. She tells Anchises that Hermes had picked her up in her own native land, literally picked her up and carried her to where Anchises is and then put her down in front of him, and she tells him that he is supposed to marry her. Anchises recognizes from Aphrodite's extraordinary beauty that she must be a goddess, and the first thing he says to her is to ask her for appropriate blessings. However, once she tells him she's a human being, he allows himself to be persuaded because she's so beautiful and so desirable that he would like to think she's a human being. His words to Aphrodite, the first thing he says to Aphrodite when he sees her, embodies the maxims of Delphi in a very interesting way. Anchises both remembers his own status as a human and is careful not to ask for excessive blessings from this goddess, and he's sure she is a goddess, who has appeared before him. He looks at her and he says, "Lady, welcome to this house, whoever of the blessed ones you are. Whether you are Artemis or Leto or golden Aphrodite or well-born Themis or gray-eyed Athena," and then he goes on and names several other goddesses just to make sure not to insult anyone by leaving her out. Then he says, "Upon a lofty peak, which can be seen for all around, I shall make you an altar and offer you fair sacrifices in all seasons. And with kindly heart grant me to be an eminent man among the Trojans, to leave flourishing offspring behind me, to live long and behold the light of the sun, prospering among the people, and so reach old age." Now, I have always found that particular prayer, as I said, to be a perfect embodiment of what it's appropriate for a human to ask for. He doesn't ask for 14 or 20 or 25 children. He just asks for flourishing offspring, offspring who will survive. He doesn't ask for a lifespan of 200 years. He just asks to reach old age. He doesn't ask for exceptional riches. He just asks to be prosperous. He's doing exactly what he ought to do, honoring the goddess and asking her for blessings that are appropriate to his status as a human being. And yet, Anchises' adherence to the Delphic maxims, his ability to know himself and to avoid excess, does not protect him. Aphrodite lies to him in order to get her own way, despite the fact that she knows it will have bad consequences for him, as we'll see in a few minutes. Aphrodite persuades Anchises that she is in fact a human being, and as I said, tells him that he's supposed to marry her. I always feel sorry for Anchises at this point of the Homeric hymn. The poor man hasn't got a chance. Sexual passion itself is standing there in front of him, bent on seducing him. There's no way he could avoid going to bed with Aphrodite, and in fact, he doesn't avoid it. After she has persuaded him that she really is a human, he says, in effect, "Great, I'll marry you, but let's go to bed right now," which of course is what she too has in mind. After the two have sex, after Aphrodite and Anchises go to bed together, Anchises falls asleep. Aphrodite wakes him by revealing herself to him as a goddess. She doesn't reveal herself in her full true form, of course, or he would be incinerated, but she does show enough of her glory that it's quite clear she's not a human. For instance, her head brushes the roof beam of the building they're in. And she asks him, she tells him to wake up and asks him, "Do I look the same way as I looked before?" Now, Anchises is terrified when he realizes that he has, in fact, slept with a goddess. And he asks her for mercy in very interesting words. He says to her, "Goddess, as soon as I saw you, I knew you were divine, but you did not tell the truth. Yet by Zeus, I beseech you not to let me live impotent among men, but to have mercy on me. For the man who lies with immortal goddesses is not left unharmed." The man who lies with immortal goddesses is not left unharmed. That's a very interesting statement, and I think it has very important implications for our understanding of the hymn, and again, for our wider understanding of the culture that developed these myths. Gods and mortals can interbreed. Their offspring are human, but are usually exceptional humans, more beautiful, more noble, braver, something like that, than everyday humans. While mating with a god often has disastrous consequences for a human woman, it does not inevitably lead to disaster. There are stories of human women who have sex with a god, bear his child, and continue to live perfectly normal and uneventful and even happy lives. Alcmene, the mother of Heracles, would be one example of such a woman. So when Anchises says the man who lies with immortal goddesses is not left unharmed, he's not stating a principle that holds for humans in general whenever they have sex with divinities. He's talking specifically about male humans who have sex with female divinities. So there must be something about that particular combination, male human with female goddess, that comprises a very great transgression. To understand why that is a transgression, to understand the imbalance and the consequences for female and male humans of sex with a divinity, we have to look again at Greek views of sexuality and gender roles and at the nature of the relationship between gods and humans. In Greek culture, as I mentioned briefly when we were discussing Artemis, sexual intercourse itself, is seen as an act of domination. The active partner dominates the passive partner. And I put it that way rather than saying the male dominates the female, because many parts of Greek culture, including Athenian society in the 5th century BC, accepted certain forms of homosexual behavior. Homosexual behavior was acceptable so long as the active partner, the penetrating partner, was a mature man and the passive partner, the penetrated partner, was an adolescent boy. In other words, what was seen as crucial was who was penetrating whom, who was dominating whom. Domination, penetration are appropriate activities for an adult male. The partner who takes the passive role and is penetrated is seen as being, in some sense, feminized by that act. This was appropriate for an adolescent boy, a boy whose beard had not yet grown, because he was not yet considered a fully adult male. Greek culture did despise and look down on adult males who took the passive role in a homosexual relationship, who allowed themselves to be penetrated. So rather than the gender of the partners involved being the crucial element of sexuality as the Greeks understood it, the crucial element is who is dominant and who is submissive, who is penetrating and who is being penetrated. Now, in a heterosexual relationship, in a male-female relationship, there's no problem at all because men are seen as dominant by nature, women are seen as submissive by nature. Therefore, in the sexual act, when a man penetrates a woman, the already dominant partner is dominating the already submissive partner, no problem. That's how, according to Greek culture, it ought to be. That's the, quote, natural, unquote, order of things. When sex occurs between a god and a human, then the gender of each partner suddenly becomes very important. If a male god, say Zeus, has sex with a female human, say Alcmene or Semele, there's no problem. The superior partner is dominating the inferior partner. The god is dominating the human, the male is dominating the female, no problem. The female may suffer disastrous consequences, like Semele does, but it is not inevitable that she will suffer disastrous consequences because she has not committed any transgression of the proper boundaries of behavior between gods and humans. But what happens when the male is human and the divinity is the female? Then we have a real contradiction in terms in the relationship as it's seen in Greek culture. we have a male dominating a female, so far so good. But we have a human dominating a goddess, so far so very not good indeed. That is the problem. By having sex with Aphrodite, Anchises has dominated, has asserted authority over, has put himself in the superior role with regards to a goddess. And that's why he's terrified, because that is without question a transgression. Furthermore, when a god and a human mate, a child always results. There was even a proverb about that that's usually translated as something along the lines of the unions of the gods are always fruitful. When a god and a human mate, there is always a child conceived, without exception, as far as I know. Now, again, the gender of the two partners, which one is the human, becomes very important here as well. If the human is female, then there's no inherent problem in her conceiving a child to a god. Her child will be greater than he otherwise would have been. I say he because it almost always is a he. Sometimes it's a she, as in Helen of Troy, but usually the child of a god and a human is male. And for a human mother to bear Heracles, for instance, is better than for her to bear a normal human child. She gets a child who is more glorious, is better in most regards than the child she otherwise would have born. So, no problem. But what about a goddess bearing a human child? What about the idea that Aphrodite will now be pregnant with a human baby, will give birth to a mortal child, will bear a son who will live for 60, 70 years at most, and then die? This is seen as degrading, as beneath a goddess's dignity. And in fact, in the hymn, Aphrodite talks to Anchises about this. She tries to reassure him. She says he won't be harmed as long as he doesn't tell anyone who the father of his son is, who the mother of his son is. She says once the child is born, she will bring him to Anchises, leave him with Anchises, and Anchises absolutely must not tell that Aphrodite is his mother. Aphrodite puts this in very strong terms. She says that she'll name the child Aeneas, which is related to the word for grief, because great grief has seized her over the fact that she shared a bed with a human. And she puts it in terms that seem to indicate that she's actually rather disgusted by the idea already, a very quick morning after reaction, that she is already disgusted by the idea that she slept with Anchises and has conceived a son to him. Now, Aphrodite's attempt to reassure Anchises in the Homeric hymn falls very flat indeed, because she tells him, as the main thread of her attempt to reassure him, she tells him the story of his kinsman Tithonus. She says, "Your family has always been particularly appealing to the gods. We really like you, Trojan royal family. Remember Tithonus, a kinsman of yours, and the dawn goddess Eos." And to try to reassure Anchises that he needn't worry about being harmed, she recounts this story. And it's a horrifying story indeed. Eos, the dawn goddess, had an affair with the human Tithonus. She wanted to keep him around. She enjoyed him so much that she wanted to make him immortal. And she did make him immortal, but she forgot to make him ageless. And so Tithonus lives forever. Tithonus cannot die. Tithonus has mortality taken away from him, but he continues to age. He grows older and older and older until eventually there's nothing left of him but a voice, a complaining voice, which Eos shuts away in a back chamber of her palace so she won't have to pay any more attention to him. As reassuring stories go, this one is remarkably unreassuring. And it also is a very good example of a theme that recurs over and over again in Greek myth, the idea that humans may desire immortality. We may think that we want immortality, but it is not appropriate for us. It doesn't work for us. We are not that kind of creature. There are various stories about humans who attempt to gain immortality, and it almost always results in total disaster. Tithonus is one of the worst examples because he gets older and older forever. He's still there. He can't die. He will never die, but he will continue to age. There's similar stories. There's one about a female lover of Apollo, the Sibyl, who, when she was in Apollo's good graces, asked for as many years of life as there were grains of sand on the shore of the sea. This was granted her, But again, eternal youth was left out. And when the Sibyl angered Apollo, he intentionally kept eternal youth back from her. So she too grows older and older. She will eventually die. The grains of sand are finite, but it's going to take a very long time. And there's stories about her in which she's withered away into a little thing that sits in a cage. Boys go by and torment her by asking her, Sibyl, what do you want? And her one and only answer is, I want to die. Very grim stories about the attempt to get immortality. Aphrodite, as I said before, tells Anchises he won't be harmed if he keeps the secret of who Aeneas' mother actually is. Apparently he did not keep the secret. For one thing, we know who Aeneas' mother was, so the hymn seems to imply that Anchises did in fact tell someone. Also, other sources tell us that Anchises did reveal that Aphrodite was his son's mother. It would be awfully hard not to brag about having had an affair with Aphrodite herself, and that he was in fact harmed, that he was lamed, he was crippled after his encounter with Aphrodite. Aphrodite has other human lovers, most notably the young man Adonis, who is killed because of his affair with Aphrodite. So the idea that human men are harmed by sexual relationships with goddesses is reiterated over and over again in almost every circumstance in which such a relationship occurs. Now, looking at Aphrodite as she is presented in the Homeric hymn, we can isolate the following characteristics of sexual passion as she represents it. Sexual passion is seen as an external force, something that comes swooping in from the outside, grabs you, drives you crazy, and makes you do things you normally would not do. It is also seen as being by nature transitory. This is not a lasting, emotionally significant relationship that Aphrodite inflicts on gods and humans. It is a transitory madness. And I'm using the term madness because it's often described that way in Greek literature, as madness or sickness. And the transitoriness of it is one of its main identifying characteristics. You may feel it today for one person, next year, next week, or even tomorrow for someone entirely different. The idea that we have in our culture that sexual attraction is a lasting emotional state on which a marriage can and should be based would, I think, have struck the ancient Greeks as the rankest insanity. That the idea that it could be stable, lasting, and significant enough to base a marriage on it simply is not there. One of the clearest articulations I know of the Greek view of sexual passion, happens to be the one complete poem that has remained by the ancient Greek poet Sappho, one of the few female writers we know of from antiquity, who lived in the 6th century B.C., early 6th century B.C., and wrote poems about and to other women, apparently, as far as we can tell. Her one complete poem that has survived is often called the Hymn to Aphrodite, and in it Sappho asks Aphrodite for help in seducing the current object of her passion. This is a translation of the poem that I did a couple of years back that I would like to read to you because I think it points out some very important aspects of Aphrodite and of sexual passion. So Sappho says, "Iridescent throned Aphrodite, deathless child of Zeus, wile weaver, I now implore you, don't, I beg you, lady, with pains and torments crush down my spirit. But before, if ever you've heard my pleadings, then return, as once when you left your father's golden house, you yoked to your shining car your wing-whirring sparrows. Skimming down the paths of the sky's bright ether, on they brought you, over the earth's black bosom, swiftly. Then you stood with a sudden brilliance, goddess, before me. Deathless face alight with your smile, you asked me what I suffered. Who was my cause of anguish? What would ease the pain of my frantic mind? And why had I called you to my side? And whom should persuasion summon here to soothe the sting of your passion this time? Who is now abusing you, Sappho? Who is treating you cruelly? Now she runs away, but she'll soon pursue you. Gifts she now rejects, soon enough she'll give them. Now she doesn't love you, but soon her heart will burn, though unwilling. Come to me once more and abate my torment. Take the bitter care from my mind and give me all I long for. Lady, in all my battles, fight as my comrade." Now, notice what Sappho does not say. She does not say, I am so emotionally bound to this person, I can't live without her. She doesn't say, this is my one and only true love. She says, come to me again. Help me this time. Be my comrade in all my battles. And the image of Aphrodite swooping down from Mount Olympus to help her devotee, to cause the object of Sappho's desire to return the desire, is, I think, a very compelling image of sexuality as an outside force imposed on us that comes for a while and then goes away and leaves us alone until the next time it comes and infects us. Later authors do give an emotional significance to sexual passion that is absent in the Homeric Hymn to Aphrodite, in Sappho, and in earlier and classical Greek works. By the time we get to Roman authors such as Ovid, whose Metamorphoses I've mentioned before in this course, we find an idea that sexual passion can be emotionally significant, or rather that a significant emotional state can include sexual passion as one of its components. Ovid tells the story, for instance, of Pyramus and Thisbe, a young couple who are forbidden to marry by their parents, who run away together and who end up committing suicide. Pyramus when he thinks Thisbe is dead, Thisbe when she discovers Pyramus's body. Yes, very much like Romeo and Juliet. But even in Ovid's account and in later authors, where emotional love, where being in love in a romantic sense seems to be taken as a significant relationship which could be a basis for marriage, sexual passion itself and Aphrodite as the embodiment of it remain capricious rather than Aphrodite being a goddess of devoted, long-lasting love. Now, the last thing I want to look at in this lecture on Aphrodite is the way she works as an example through which we can explore the question that I'm very frequently asked by students of whether the ancient Greeks actually believed in these gods or not. That strikes many modern people as a crucial question about a religious system. I like to use Aphrodite as a means to discuss it because I think she gives us a very good insight into the way in which that question is almost unaskable with this kind of god. With gods who are, in effect, personifications of natural forces, the question of belief is not really a matter of debate, isn't something that comes up the way it does in a monotheistic religion. Aphrodite personifies sexual passion, controls sexual passion. If we could summon up a 5th or 6th or 7th century BC Greek person and ask him or her, do you believe in Aphrodite? There's a sense in which that would be as foolish a question as if I looked at one of you and asked, tell me, is there such a thing as sexual passion? Do you think it exists? The question is ludicrous. Of course there's such a thing as sexual passion. Of course it exists. In a system in which gods and goddesses, like Aphrodite, are personifications of that kind of natural force, to ask, do you believe in Aphrodite? Do you think that such a thing as Aphrodite exists? Is as meaningless or as silly as asking, do you think that such a thing as sexual passion exists? Of course they exist. All human experience tells us they exist. Now, the question of whether personification is an appropriate way to represent these forces of nature, that is a question that can indeed be asked. And as philosophy developed in Athens in the 5th and 4th centuries BC, thinkers did begin to question, is personification an appropriate way to represent these forces of nature? But the question of belief that's so crucial in monotheistic religions, that in fact is the defining point of monotheistic religions, if you do not believe in Christ, you are not a Christian. If you do not believe in Allah, you are not a Muslim. That kind of question of belief simply doesn't apply in a polytheistic system such as we have with the Olympian gods. Aphrodite is also an excellent illustration of the irrelevance, not just the futility, but the irrelevance of expecting compassion, mercy, or pity from this kind of personified natural force. It is a reality of human experience, regret it though we may, that inappropriate sexual desire can devastate and destroy innocent lives. We see that all the time. I'm sure everyone has some experience of that through friends, at least, if not in their own lives. Similarly, if we look at Dionysus, it is a sad fact of human experience that inappropriate use of alcohol, of wine, can devastate and destroy innocent human lives. It is meaningless to ask Aphrodite to feel pity or mercy, or to ask Dionysus to feel pity or mercy, when we think of them as personifications of sexual passion, of wine, that sort of thing. They can destroy us. They do destroy us. They feel no mercy for us. That's what they are. That's what they do. That's the kind of entity they are. Now, that means that the personification of these natural forces carries with it a kind of contradiction built into the system, so to speak. As sentient beings, Aphrodite and Dionysus and the rest ought to be able to feel pity. The fact that they cannot makes them in some sense less than humans, not greater than humans. And it's this kind of contradiction, this sense that sentient beings should be able to feel pity, and yet these personified natural forces can't and don't. That contradiction starts to be explored in some of the great literature of the 5th century BC and in philosophy as well. So, in this lecture, we've finished our survey of individual Olympian deities. In the next lecture, we're going to take a slightly different tack and step back a bit from Greek culture and look at the cultural and historical background that's at play in some of the myths we've studied so far.